Well, hello. Welcome to our on-demand conference call, CLE. We're coming to you live today on May 2nd, 2022, but most of you will be taking the program as the on-demand podcast. My name is Richard Klemm. I will be your host tonight for this two-hour CLE program, in which we'll be talking about the elimination of bias. This program is being offered for CLE credit, especially in Minnesota and Iowa, where that type of program is required. But hopefully, even those of you admitted in other states will get some useful information out of tonight's program, learn something to make yourself a little bit better attorney. During the course of the program, I am going to be giving a series of code numbers, and I use those to take attendance. So when I give a code number at some point in the program, be sure to write it down, unless you're driving or something, safety first. Write down the code number and send them to me at the end of the program, so I can use those to record attendance. And I understand things happen. You might miss one of them or something. I'm not heartless, so if you miss one, don't worry too much about it. Just explain what happened and send me the code numbers that you did get. And when you do that, please send those codes to me. The easiest way to do that is by email. My address is clem.law@usa.net, clem.law@usa.net. And as soon as I get that, I can record your attendance and send you a certificate allowing you to report your attendance at this program to the state CLE board in whatever state you're reporting in. Again, my name is Richard Klemm, and I'm an attorney. I've been in practice, about 30 years now, so I've been at it for a little while. Several years ago, I decided to get into the continuing legal education business, have kind of a variety of programs. The one subject that's always been popular has been my program on ethics. Because that's required in most states, I offer that and some miscellaneous ones. I get other attorneys to speak occasionally, or sometimes I will do some research and present the program myself. But one subject in Minnesota that was always I had attorneys keep asking me about it is, well, are you going to present an elimination of bias program? Because for probably close to 20 years now, attorneys in Minnesota have been required to receive at least 2 credits of elimination of bias training. And sometimes it's getting a little bit better now, but at one point those courses were sometimes a little bit hard to find. So I kept getting requests for those. I told attorneys, that's not really my strong point. That's not something I really know a lot about. But the requests kept coming in. So I decided maybe I better educate myself and try to figure out how to put that program together. The result of that, after giving this program many times over the last several years, hopefully it will be a program that will enlighten you a little bit and hopefully eliminate some of your biases. Now, the disclaimer I always start with, or the first point I like to start with on these, is there's often a lot of trepidation. And I had the same trepidation before I started presenting CLE programs. There was a certain amount of trepidation when I went in to get one of my required elimination of bias programs. And that trepidation was, well, those people up there on the stage might be talking down to me. It might be a little bit condescending. They might stand up there and tell me that I should be like them. They are unbiased. I am biased. And you down there in the audience, you stop being biased. Well, to a certain extent, that I have been to some programs where that was indeed the case. That's what I heard, and I got my credits, and I don't know if they eliminated any of my bias. I always get something out of every program I go to. I don't know if that's the most productive way to present this kind of program. The one thing I promise not to do during this program is to be condescending or talk down to you or say that you are more biased than I am. Because the disclaimer I start the program out with is, I'm probably just as biased as you are. I would be lying if I didn't admit that to you, because as I think we'll learn as we think about this issue a little bit more during the course of the program, I think we will come to the conclusion, that all of us have some kinds of biases. I have biases, and there are certainly people out there who are more malicious than I am. Or there are people out there who are, more evil than I am. But I don't think there are other people out there who are necessarily very much more biased than I am. Bias is something that comes naturally. Bias is something that is part of our natural upbringing. To say that we have no bias, as the scriptures would say, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we were to say that, I don't think that's a helpful starting point for anybody to say, I'm free from bias, and I'm going to teach you how to be free from bias. And also, the title of the course in Minnesota is Elimination of Bias, and perhaps that's not an achievable goal. Perhaps I'm not going to eliminate anybody's bias in the course of the next 2 hours, but I think what we can do, though, is recognize some of our biases over the couple of hours. And in fact, during the course of me presenting this program over the course of several years, I think I've come to recognize more of my biases. And as you've discovered, the CLE world is moving more toward the on-demand podcast model, where you're going to sit and listen to me talk for the next 2 hours, rather than having us sit in a room together where we have a discussion. And I think this program actually would be better suited for all of us sitting together in one room having a discussion talking about it. Because the other times that I've presented the program, when I've sat around with other attorneys, I think I have learned a lot more about the subject. Maybe I learned more than I actually was able to teach. But I think everybody learned from one another, because when we can sit down and discuss these matters, I think we do a little bit better at being able to recognize some of our biases. So unfortunately, with this model where I just have to sit here and lecture you for a while, that's probably not going to come out quite as well. So I do invite you to share with me any thoughts that you might have, to educate me a little bit more on the subject, for one thing, and also to give me ideas of things to talk about future programs. Because the first time I did this program, I don't know, I muddled through it, and I did a pretty good job, I think. But I've certainly gotten a lot better over the years. And the reason why I've done that is just because I've had the opportunity to talk to hundreds of different attorneys and get their perspective on some of these issues. Thereby I've been able to better recognize some of my own biases, when I admit to some of the biases that I recognize in myself, maybe you will see that you have some of those biases also. I don't think it's a realistic goal to say that we're going to eliminate anybody's biases during the course of this presentation. But like I say, I think it is a pretty achievable goal to say to ourselves that we can recognize some biases in ourselves. And thereby, maybe we will eliminate some of them, because I'm a fair-minded person, just as I'm sure that you are a fair-minded person. You don't want to be prejudiced against anybody. You want to treat everybody fairly. You don't want to be biased against anybody. And for the most part, those are the goals that you set for yourselves in life. And for the most part, you are fair. You do treat everybody fairly. But if you recognize that you have some bias that you otherwise did not recognize, well, once you recognize that, then it makes it easier for you to treat everybody fairly. So I think it is an important topic to talk about, and especially in the last couple of years, this has really come to the forefront. Some of the issues we've seen in our news stories in the last couple of years, over the course of the pandemic, over the course of the unrest that's taken place, where some of these issues have become important. So we're going to be learning about elimination of bias. Now, one change that's happened I've given this course very much is that another state has joined us. The program used to be entitled Minnesota Elimination of Bias. Well, also now it's entitled Iowa Diversity and Inclusion. Because our colleagues in Iowa are now taking this program. It has a slightly different title, but my Minnesota program was always approved right away for credit in Iowa. Because Iowa attorneys, starting in 2021, have been required instead of the old requirement of 1 hour of 2 hours of ethics, now they have the requirement of 1 hour of ethics and 1 hour per year of either attorney wellness or diversity and inclusion. So this year you're getting your one credit with diversity and inclusion. I encourage you next year to maybe seek out that one credit in attorney wellness. And if you have trouble finding such a course, one recommendation I would give for you on that is that I know the two places in Minnesota have excellent free courses that cover that topic. I don't know if they're approved for Iowa credit yet. And Minnesota colleagues, I certainly encourage you to seek these programs out as well. But I know the Minnesota State Law Library always has an excellent program covering that subject, addressing attorney wellness, as does an organization in Minnesota called Minnesota Lawyers, Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers. An attorney assistance organization in Minnesota designed to help attorneys who are suffering from mental health or chemical dependency issues. And as part of their mission, they offer an excellent CLE credit discussing that. So, again, I encourage you to seek out those programs because when that CLE deadline is looming, you want to find some of the free ones. And those are a couple of excellent free programs. So I encourage you to seek those out, especially next year, you Iowa attorneys, when you need that attorney wellness credit. Or you can take this one again, the diversity and inclusion. But again, before I got off on that tangent, the Iowa requirement now requires either that attorney wellness or diversity and inclusion. The first question is, what are these programs about? For a number of years, I went to Minnesota Elimination of Bias programs, and I never did quite figure out, just by attending the programs, what the definition was of what the required subject matter was to be at those programs. So I did actually look it up, and the Minnesota CLE rule regarding elimination of bias programs says the topics we're supposed to discuss are We have choices. One is we can discuss the issues that prevent attorneys of color or attorneys for whatever reasons, such as race or gender, or something else that served as a barrier to employment. We can specifically address those barriers to employment, and we'll be discussing some of those in the course of discussing everything else. But the general topic that we're supposed to discuss is we are supposed to discuss the various reports put out by the Minnesota Supreme Court discussing racial bias in the courts. And the big one that we'll start with here in a couple minutes is the report that they issued in 1993. The Supreme Court Task Force on Racial Bias in the Courts released its report. And we're supposed to talk about that report and the subsequent reports that come out after that. And mostly we're going to be talking about those subsequent reports. And, of course, we're supposed to talk about the substantive topics addressed by those reports. So we will be discussing those reports of the Supreme Court during the course of this program. Iowa. So, in other words, when they wrote the requirement for this rule, they kind of knew what they were supposed to be talking about, but they didn't really do a good job of defining it. They kind of said, well, we're going to talk about the reports issued by the Supreme Court about elimination of bias. That's what we're going to talk about. That's what elimination of bias means. Iowa did a little bit better job, in coming up with a definition of the subject matter of tonight's program, because in Iowa, the words diversity inclusion means a separate, designated, dedicated session of instruction, so in other words, a separate class, regarding the impact of race, sex, gender, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, marital status, socioeconomic status, or political affiliation. That's new that they added that. The impact that all those things have on court system interaction or case or controversy outcome. So how do all of those things affect court system interaction and case outcome? And also, we are supposed to discuss professional relationships between how they affect professional relationships between attorneys, judges, and clients, where race, sex, gender, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, marital status, socioeconomic status, or political affiliation is a potential factor. So it's pretty wide open what the definition is. But like I say, I think Iowa, and they had a few more years to work on the definition. I think they came up with a little bit better definition, although perhaps there was some wisdom in the Minnesota approach of just saying, well, we're gonna talk about the stuff that the Supreme Court is talking about. So that's the subject matter of this program, whether we call it, and I think those two definitions are pretty similar, and I know some other states have a similar requirement. I believe California and Florida have similar requirements, so I think some other states out there. So if you're taking it for one of those states, or if you're taking it in some other state and you're just taking it for general CLE credit, well, perhaps a similar requirement will be added to your state's requirements one day. Now, the first time I presented this program, I didn't know where to start. Well, I finally discovered those reports from the Supreme Court were out there, but I needed some kind of a starting point. And so my starting point is, well, what do the court rules have to say about this? I have kind of a general understanding that I'm not supposed to be biased and prejudiced. So what exactly do the court rules have to say about that? And the rules do say a little bit about it. First of all, in Minnesota, our general rules of practice. So we have our rules of civil procedure, we have our rules of criminal procedure, and then we also have just the overarching general rules. So I think Rule 1 says there's supposed to be a flag in the courtroom. So it's kind of the, you know, real basic rules of how the district courts operate. Rule 2.02 says what the duty of judges is in the courtroom. And Rule 2.03 explains what the role of attorneys is in the courtroom. And they're pretty similar, except, well, it says the judges are supposed to be dignified. Lawyers are apparently not required to be dignified, but you should be. Things go a lot more smoothly when you are, if you follow that same rule that applies to the judges. Be dignified, courteous, respectful, and considerate of everybody. That's always helpful. But both of them say that we shall treat everybody, namely parties, participants, other lawyers, and court personnel, fairly. We have to treat everybody fairly, and we must not discriminate on the basis of race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, sexual orientation, status with regard to public assistance, disability, or age. So we have that long list of things about which we're not supposed to discriminate, kind of similar to that Iowa list that I rattled off a couple of minutes ago. So when we're in court, we have to treat everybody fairly, and we shall not discriminate. We have to treat everybody fairly. So in other words, this is not just a subject that, you know, is just kind of a feel-good subject. Well, there is some substantive law behind it. We are required to treat everybody fairly. Similarly, the rules of professional conduct, I quote the Minnesota version here, but the Iowa version is almost identical. It's a professional misconduct for us to harass anybody on the basis of any of those grounds: sex, race, age, creed, color, national origin, disability, sexual orientation, or marital status. It's a violation of the rules to harass anybody on those grounds in connection with our professional activities. So you look, there's a loophole. I can harass and discriminate and everything when I'm off the job. Well, no, because the next provision says that it's a violation of the rules of professional conduct to commit any discriminatory act that's prohibited by a state, federal, or local ordinance in any time. Now, whether or not it takes place during your professional activities, that might be an aggravating or mitigating factor. But we as attorneys are required to not discriminate even when it's not in the practice of law. So if you violate an anti-discrimination law, even though it's not in the course of the practice of law, that's a violation of the rules of professional conduct. So we don't want to do that. So I used those several years ago, the first time I gave this program, because I needed a starting point. I needed somewhere to jump off from. That seemed like as good a spot as any. But like I say, it just serves as a reminder that elimination of bias, you know, or as we call it in Minnesota, or diversity and inclusion, as we call it in Iowa, is not just a good idea. There is some substantive law saying that we are supposed to be doing that. Like I say, what we're supposed to talk about, I rattled off that Iowa definition, but in Minnesota, the requirement is we're supposed to discuss the reports promulgated by the Minnesota Supreme Court on the subject of racial bias, diversity, and inclusion. And the first report along those lines, and before we do that, I should probably begin with our first code number. And our first code number for this part of the program is B782. B as in bias, 782. B782 is the first code number. So again, write down B782 so you can report that to me at the end of the program along with the other code numbers so that I can So I know that you were here in the audience. I know that you're in attendance. But anyway, in 1993, and this was kind of a forward look, the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1993 said to itself, let's take a hard look at the question of whether there is racial bias in the courts of the state of Minnesota. And what they did in order to do that, this whole program was headed up by Justice Rosalie Wahl, W-A-H-L. Justice Wall, who I consider one of the great jurists of the 20th century. She was the first woman appointed to the Minnesota Supreme Court, when she was initially appointed, I believe she was appointed by Governor Perpich, there was a little bit of resistance to that because the argument was made that, well, she was appointed only because she was a woman, there was so surely she's not the most qualified person for the job. She was just appointed because she was a woman, and in fact, after her appointment, for those of you not from Minnesota, how our system works here is most judges in the state of Minnesota are appointed initially by the governor. It doesn't always happen that way, but it usually happens that way because judges in this state traditionally retire not at the end of their 6-year term, but at some point during their term, and then the governor is called upon to appoint a replacement for any judge or justice in the state to serve out the remainder of that term. After the expiration of the term, then there is an election, just pretty much as every other contested political race in the state. Traditionally, people kind of go along with whoever the governor is appointed, and they are rarely. There's rarely a contested judicial race in Minnesota. It happens now and then, but most judges, especially at the district court level and even at the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals level, they rarely have contested judicial races. So that appointment by the governor is usually the final word, and that person generally serves until they retire at the age of 70. But in the case of Justice Wall, that was not the case. She was appointed by the governor, and there was this sense out there that she was not the most qualified person for the job. She was only appointed because she was a woman. When she faced one of those rare contested judicial races, because some candidate I have no idea who it was, I don't remember him, nobody remembers the name of that other candidate, ran against her because, she was appointed only because she's a woman. I'm obviously the most qualified candidate for the job of all the lawyers in the state, so vote for me instead. But that other person didn't win. She won her re-election. And I think she went on to prove that she was the most qualified person for the job. So I think Governor Perpich did in fact fulfill his constitutional duty of appointing the most qualified person for that that job. Again, I think one of the most distinguished jurists of the century was Justice Wall. After that beginning of her career, obviously, I think the question of bias in the courts was something that she was particularly attuned to, and she was tasked, like I say, to head up this committee, the Task Force on Racial Bias in the Courts. What did this task force do? Well, they conducted public hearings throughout the state, and they simply asked people the question of, is there bias in the court system? If you would have asked me that question, I was admitted in about 1989, I think, or 88, was it? If you would have asked me, an attorney who'd been in practice for 5 years, hey, Clem, is there racial bias in the Minnesota court system? I would, of course, said to you, of course not. This is just a waste of taxpayers' money going on this, fishing expedition trying to find bias in the court system. So I would have shrugged it off and said, no, of course not. We don't have to worry anything about that. Let's just get down to the business of fairly and justly applying the law and not worrying about these ancillary topics like racial bias. So that's what I would have said in 1993. Well, it's a good thing they didn't ask me. Because I can tell you right now that if they would have asked me that question, that's the answer I would have given, and that would have been the wrong answer. Because no matter how skeptical one is, if you read this the 355-page report, and no, I haven't read all 355 pages of it, But if you read the report prepared by that task force almost 30 years ago in 1993, now if you look at that report, you do, even the skeptic like me, has to grudgingly come to the conclusion that, well, yes, I guess there is some bias in the Minnesota court system. Or at the very least, there's a perception of bias in the Minnesota court system. Now, let's talk about that for a minute, because on some of these things, some of these topics of bias that we're going to talk about during the course of this program, some of them will look at them, and I think we can. I think you would probably be correct to say, well, that's not something that's really wrong with the court system, either in Minnesota or in Iowa or any other state. These people think that the system is unfair because this or that happened. So people can make that accusation. People can make that charge. But I don't think that's really true. And like I say, there are some situations we'll get to during the course of the program where I think, we can fairly come to that conclusion. So there's no actual bias in the court system, but there is perceived bias in the court system. Well, I guess we can be somewhat thankful that there's no real bias when we encounter those things, but that perceived bias is unfortunately almost as bad, or maybe even worse than the actual bias, because we as attorneys, how do we make our living? We make our living, because people come to us because they think the system will settle their disputes in a fair and just fashion. That's how we make our living. If significant portions of the public start coming to the conclusion that the courts are just a racket, lawyers are just a racket, they will not give you a fair resolution to this controversy because they are biased against us. Even if that perception is totally false, well, then if people have that perception, then they are going to figure out other methods of redressing their grievances, and we as patriotic Americans should be a little bit concerned about that, that people are not following the rule of law, but for purely selfish motives, we as attorneys should be a little bit concerned about that, people are not do not believe that the system of which we are part is fair. So we have to have a fair system. We have to have a system that is free of bias. We have to have a system that promotes, in the title of our Iowa program, diversity and inclusion. We have to have those things. But just as important, we have to have the perception. We have to have people believing that we have a fair system. So even if we have a perfect court system, well, that's not, I'm not saying we have a perfect system, but even if we achieve the goal of having a perfectly fair court system, that's not the end of our work. We have to make sure that all members of the public are aware of the fact and believe the fact and have faith in the fact that the system is not biased against them. And when you read this 1993 355-page report, and I encourage you to take a look at it, and I'll tell we're not going to look at it specifically tonight, because the reason why is we're going to look at some more recent reports. But when you look at that 1993 report, even the skeptic like me, who, if you would have asked in 1993, is there bias and prejudice in the Minnesota court system, I would have said, of course not. Even the skeptic like me has to look at that 1993 report and come to the conclusion that, well, maybe there is something to it. Maybe there are some areas where we are not doing a perfect job yet. Or at the very least, there are some areas where the public does not fully realize that we are not doing a perfect job. Now, we can pat ourselves on the back after we read that 1993 report. That was 30 years ago, and we've made a lot of improvements in those 30 years. So like I say, we can congratulate ourselves on what a good job we've done in some areas. But unfortunately, if you look at that 1993 report written 30 years ago, well, it doesn't jump out at you as being, you don't look at it and say, wow, I can tell just by looking at this that this is an ancient document, that none of the stuff being written about in here is true anymore. And a lot of the stuff in that 1993 report really hasn't changed very much. So in other words, while we have made some strides in some areas, we still have a lot of work to do. Now, we're not going to be looking at that 1993 report, because what we are going to do is look at some of the more recent reports that are not particularly different. And in fact, the reports we're going to be looking at run between 2008 and 2021. Because what the course materials that you have in front of you, if you have them in front of you, you don't need to follow along or anything, more of a reference material and some notes to keep me on track. But the course materials that we have are kind of the minutes or the notes taken at public listening sessions that took place between 2008 and 2021, and hopefully are continuing. And when I update this program in a year or so, I suppose I'll have some new material added into it. But the Minnesota Supreme Court, instead of simply disbanding this 1993 task force, they created a new committee called the Implementation Committee on Multicultural Diversity and Racial Fairness in the Courts. They soon discovered that that didn't fit on their business cards, I think, when they printed that. That was kind of a pretty long title. So it's now known as the Committee for Equality and Justice. It's a committee of the Minnesota Supreme Court made up of justices of that court and judges in the district court and other constituencies and members of the public. It's a committee that continues to look into these issues of equality and justice. And what they have been doing to do that is simply going out into the community and having listening sessions. Go to various places within the state and just ask members of the public, tell us, as the court system, how we are doing. Tell us whether we are being fair. Tell us whether there is bias in the Minnesota court system. Tell us how we are doing when it comes to diversity and inclusion. Simply asking members of the public to answer those questions. And interestingly, the answers to those questions are not very different from the ones in 1993. And those are specifically the answers to those questions. So after my long introduction now, what are we going to be talking about in tonight's program? Well, we are going to be hearing the members of the public answering that question, because this Committee on Equality and Justice held these listening sessions at various locations throughout the state. Simply ask the members of the public to, you know, tell us how we're doing when it comes to diversity and inclusion and elimination of bias. And we're just going to hear the answers. And in most cases, it was just very open-ended what was asked in those sessions. A couple of things stood out to me was that the responses to that question are, you get a lot of the same answers over and over in different parts of the state. I think recently what they're doing is making sure they do it on a regular basis, once or twice a year in every judicial district in the state. So they cover, urban areas, Hennepin and Ramsey County. They cover suburban areas of, Anoka County and Dakota County and Washington County, places like that. And they cover small cities, such as Duluth and Rochester and Mankato, and rural parts of the state as well. So they've kind of been everywhere asking that same question, and in general they come up with the same result. They get or a lot of the same answers. Of course, a lot of the things that are heard will vary depending upon what part of the state they're in, but they do a lot of the same topics come up everywhere. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. We're going to be hearing about what those sessions have had to say in various parts of the state. And the course materials that you have in front of you, on the court website, you can find reports from the individual listening sessions. So you'll find a summary of what was said at the listening session in Minneapolis on so-and-so date, or the one that was held in Wilmer on so-and-so date. And what I've done for the course materials is I just kind of took those reports and the topics that were discussed, I kind of lumped them together so we can talk about them in kind of topics. So, with that long introduction, what have members of the public said when asked the question of how are we doing when it comes to diversity and inclusion and elimination of bias in our court systems in this state? And the first one, I lumped together a lot of comments here that come under the same category, where people said in answer to that question is, well, what the court system has to do is educate and train people better. It's, educate employees, educate attorneys. So in other words, what we're trying to do during the course of this program, people in the court system have to be educated to be more courteous, compassionate, understanding, humble, and tolerant of racial and societal differences. And the one thing that jumped out at me was the use of the word humble at one of these listening sessions, because if I want to hire an attorney, I probably don't want a humble attorney. If I need somebody representing me, I probably don't want an attorney with too much humility. I want somebody who's going to be a little bit more aggressive. But on the other hand, there is a place for us as attorneys to have some humility, and sometimes that humility can help us become much better attorneys. And how that comes up is a good example of that was at the listening session that was held in Hinckley, Minnesota. Now, again, these sessions were held to various locations throughout the state. Many of the results are the same. But the kind of the unique thing that at the session in Hinckley was there's a large Native American population in that area. So that addressed a lot of the issues facing Native American people. But again, I think we'll find that this same uh, this same kind of comment might have been made in a lot of places. But anyway, one of the elders of that community, the Ojibwe community around Pine County, one of the elders of that community recounted a story about one of the younger members of that band, who was he was one of these people who has frequent contact with law enforcement. So in other words, not necessarily somebody who's necessarily in very much trouble, but there are a certain number of people who are always seem to be around when there is trouble, and they keep running into to the cops quite a bit. If you're a law enforcement officer, you know that those people with whom you have frequent contact, sometimes the frequent contact isn't necessarily very pleasant contact. And this gentleman was one of those people. He was a person who was always seemed to be there when something bad was happening. And anyway, this sheriff's deputy was talking to this tribal elder one day and said, you know, what do I do with old so and so? As I always keep running into him, he always has a chip on his shoulder. He always seems to be, he's always where the trouble is, and he's just bad news. You know, how do I deal with somebody like that? And this tribal elder, I think, very very wisely said to him, well, you know, here, try this. Next time you run into him, just say to him, Anin Buzu. Now, I'm sure I butchered the pronunciation of that, but that is simply saying hello. That's just a greeting in the Ojibwe language. And I'm sure I butchered it. And I'm sure that some Pine County Sheriff's deputy probably butchered it even worse than I did. But he was prevailed upon to say, you know, when you run into this guy, you know, instead of saying, hey, you, what are you doing over there? You know, what's wrong? Just try saying that. Just try saying Anin Buzu to the guy and see what happens. And I can imagine this gruff sheriff's deputy probably was a little bit reluctant to, I figured, well, it's worth a try. So he saw this guy and rolled up in a squad car and he said to the guy, Anin Buzu. And he said it was like magic. That really turned this. It really changed the dynamic of the situation, and it made it much more easy to deal with. It's just that tiny gesture, just that small gesture of humility, of greeting the person in their own language. In fact, I've had this a few times where, you know, I know a few words here and there, various different languages. I don't speak too many languages very well, but for example, I know the word in Arabic. I know the word salam, which is just hello, and on more than one occasion, I've talked to somebody where I know one of their languages is Arabic. So I say to them, the first thing I say to them is salam, and it's like I'm their oldest friend. This huge trust level that comes from that, just from that tiny gesture. So I can imagine this, and again, I probably butchered it. I probably didn't say it very well. But again, just that kind of tiny gesture, just that humility of being willing to say a couple of words to somebody in their own language, that really does go a long way to doing away with misunderstandings. In fact, early in my career, I had a client from an Arabic speaking country. And he was new to the country. He had only been here a little while. Anyway, his first name, and I can say what his first name is because it's a pretty common first name. So I'm not giving away any confidential information. It's just like, you know, I once had a client named John. You know, it was a pretty common name. Well, he had a pretty common name. It was Eid, spelled E-I-D. anyway, he came into my office one day talking about something, and I shook hands with him and I said, "Hello, Aid." And he practically fell out of the chair because I was the first American who had ever said his name right. And mostly just because I was lucky, but I looked at his name spelled E-I-D, and I, you know, most people, you know, if you looked at that in an English word, you would say it's Eid, E-I-D. But I just guessed that his name was not in English, so there are two vowels there. I probably pronounced two vowel sounds, so I just guessed, and guessed correctly, it turns out, that his name was pronounced A-E-D, two syllables. Well, I was the first American who had ever said his name right. And just that tiny little act of being able to do that, like I say, mostly luck on my part, not that I'm necessarily very smarter than anybody else, but just that luck on my part really there was just a huge trust level after that. You know, so in kind of got its start from that. Let's give our next code number. That'll be B861. Our next code number is B861. 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 B861 is our second code number for this portion of the program. So again, that's, like I say, just starting out there, that when you're dealing with somebody from another culture, that humility or that vulnerability of, you know, possibly saying it wrong, possibly having the person laugh at you because you're mispronouncing this, you know, Anid Muzu or Salam or whatever, that humility can really go a long way to promote understanding, and so keep that in mind. That understanding of societal differences and tolerance sometimes does just start with humility. So I put that first just because, just in general, that's something we ought to do. We ought to be more courteous, compassionate, understanding, know what these racial and societal differences are. But humility, I think, is a good starting point for that. Turning now to some of the kind of substantive topics that come up is, now, this first one is one where you might say, well, wait a minute, what does that have to do with bias in the court system? Because this could apply to any litigant. Because many litigants, when asked, you know, how is the Minnesota court system biased against you, they'll say, well, we don't understand the court proceedings. The court is too difficult to navigate. So you can look through some of these comments here. The court system is too difficult to understand and navigate. There should be the defendants don't in criminal cases, defendants don't really understand the terms set forth in the pretrial release. We had one case it was recounted that this defendant got himself arrested because the judge rattled off the conditions of probation. The judge, had this boilerplate list of things conditions of release, and one of the conditions was release was report to the probation office immediately after court today. And the guy didn't understand that. So, but the judge rattled off these conditions, you know, no same or similar, no alcohol, blah, 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 report to the probation office, room so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. And he rattled off all these boilerplate conditions of probation. And the defendant, for whatever reason, didn't understand what was going on. So they got finished in the courtroom. Well, what did he do? He went home. Well, he wasn't supposed to go home. He was supposed to report to the probation office. So there was an arrest warrant the very first day. Well, you know, the guy should have understood that. And what did that have to do with his race or ethnicity? Maybe nothing. But on the other hand, people were asked, tell us your experiences about bias in the court system. And one of the people said, you know, there was bias in the court system because I didn't fully understand what I was supposed to do. Maybe that had nothing to do with his race or gender or anything else, but he thought it did. So at the very least, there is a perception of bias there. Like I say, that perception of bias can be just as important as actual bias. So what can we as attorneys do about this? We'll actually talk about this a little bit later. You know, if people don't understand the court system, and I think it's safe to say that, you know, perhaps the people who don't understand the court system might be people who are not born in this country, who did not grow up in this country. So that's one particular area where this could arise, is people not understanding court proceedings because they are unfamiliar with the American judicial system in general. Well, that's one area where, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, you know, about what can we as attorneys do about this. What can we do? Because after all, the topic of tonight's program is elimination of bias. So what can you and I do to eliminate the bias? Well, maybe we should be thinking about some of these things. Maybe you and I should be the ones who look for opportunities to reach out to the community and explain how our system works a little bit better. But like I say, we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But that's one topic that came up quite often at some of these listening sessions, of litigants not understanding court proceedings, sometimes based upon language, sometimes not always based upon language. Now, speaking of language, that's one area where we've actually done a pretty good job since 1993. Because if you look at that original 1993 report, you will see that, you know, the court system didn't always do an excellent job in providing interpreters to people who, you know, couldn't understand the court system. And in general, we couldn't understand the proceedings because of the language, I should say. And in general, we've done, I think, an excellent job of providing interpreters in situations where, A, there's a formal court proceeding going on, B, they are, well, a defendant, a criminal defendant in that proceeding, or maybe a civil litigant in that proceeding. So in those formal situations, we've done a pretty good job. Now, some of the civil litigation, maybe we haven't done quite as good of a job, but where we definitely have not done as good a job is in the informal interactions with the court system. So, in other words, if you are charged with some kind of an offense and you go to court and, you know, you have a trial today, you have a jury trial, well, chances are you're probably going to have a pretty good interpreter who helps you understand the proceedings during your jury trial. But most of the time that people interact with the court system, it's not a jury trial. It's not even a court hearing. More often than not, it's at the window of the court clerk's office trying to figure out what's going on. So in other words, you know, this happened a few years ago. What was my ticket for? I think for not having proof of insurance or something. I had something like that. Our tabs were expired. The tabs were expired on the car, so we got a ticket for it. The car was parked somewhere, and we got a ticket for expired tabs, and I had to go to court. But you know, there was no jury trial or anything like that. I looked up the court proceedings, and you know, of course, as soon as I get the ticket, the first thing I do is race down to the deputy registrar's office and get the tabs, get it taken care of, because they had expired a couple of days before. But we had this ticket, so I had to go. I had to physically go to court to show them that I did it. So I think I had to call first or something. And in this the particular county that I was in where this happened, they were kind of sticklers for it. I had to show the new tabs, and I had to bring in a photograph of the license plate showing those new tabs. So in other words, I had to navigate this whole system. I had to talk to them on the phone, or maybe I looked it up online, what I had to bring in. And I had to bring in all these materials, and I had to get in the right line at the courthouse, and I had to find out where the courthouse was. It was one of the suburban courthouses. Well, somebody who does not speak English as their first language, that would be a pretty daunting procedure. And even though we have interpreters, when I have my jury trial, well, hopefully it doesn't go to a jury trial just because my license tabs are expired. So that is one area where we have not done as good of a job. Litigants not understanding court proceedings because of language, yeah, if it's an actual formal court proceeding going on. But on the other hand, we have to look for ways to make that system easier to navigate. Now, does that mean we're supposed to coddle people like me who let their license tabs expire? Well, no, but we don't want the whole system to break down because a bench warrant gets issued just because I was a couple days late on getting my tabs. It's a lot better if the whole system runs a lot more efficiently and a lot more smoothly if everybody knows what they're supposed to be doing. And I was able to figure it out with a little bit of difficulty, even though I'm reasonably intelligent. Number two, I speak English. Number three, I'm a lawyer. But I still had to figure out exactly what hoops I had to jump through in that particular county to prove my innocence throw myself on the mercy of the court that I did have expired tabs. I'm really sorry, but I got them fixed. Is everybody able to do that as smoothly as I was? And if not, well, that truly is one type of bias in the court system. I'm going to give one more code number here, and that would be B947 is our third code number for this segment of the program. And at this point, we've got about an hour. So for those of you in Iowa, you have now completed your 1 hour of diversity and inclusion. Although we encourage you to tune back in for the second half of the program. You'll get another general CLE credit out of that. And, of course, those of you in Minnesota, you need 2 credits of elimination of bias. So we'll get that second credit taken care of here after we take a short break. But once again, that final code number for this segment of the program is B947. B947. And we'll see you in a few minutes for part 2.